Can you please take your seats now so that we can start?
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Is Margaret coming? Are you Margaret?
Okay.
Margaret.
Good afternoon, everybody. The fourth meeting of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, we shall now proceed to deal with agenda item 3B. I will look at the leftovers from this from the list under 3B, and then we will proceed to agenda item 3C after we are done with 3B. I open the floor to the participants inscribed on the list of speakers to make their statements, and I again reiterate that you are given a time limit of 5 minutes if you are you have a collective statement, but 3 minutes if it's just an individual organizational statement. So I would like to call on Margarita Sukari Kari, an Indigenous parliamentarian who is a Congresista de Peru. Is Margarita Sukari Kari in the room? No? Okay, let's call on Ellen Gabriel, who is from the Quebec Native Women Incorporated. Yes, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Permanent Forum delegates, honored elders, and all my relations. It is a great honor that we are participating today on behalf of the many Indigenous women who could not be here today. While we are encouraged by the various reports of the UN Permanent Forum, there remains much work to be done for the world's Indigenous peoples. Canada and other states that continue to oppose the UN Declaration have demonstrated a lack of respect and understanding of this important instrument that would truly address the discrimination of Indigenous people, in particular Indigenous women. Due to the impacts of colonization, Indigenous women suffer multiple discriminations based on race, gender, and economic status. Indigenous women's roles and authority are targeted and undermined through legislation under Canada's Indian Act. Decolonization should include traditional governance structures whereby Indigenous women are partners in decision-making processes. In Canada, forced assimilation practices are evident in policies and programs which threaten the nationality and identity of Indigenous peoples. Therefore, it is important that we create our own governance structures that reflect women's roles in order to prevent further assimilation of Indigenous peoples. The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is an international instrument that addresses the situation of multiple discriminations faced by Indigenous women, even though the Canadian government has yet to endorse the declaration. It is therefore disappointing to note that the Government of Canada continues to oppose the declaration that recognizes the equal rights of Indigenous peoples. While some attempts have been made by Canada to provide Indigenous women and their communities access to human rights instruments, the Indian Act continues to undermine the equality of Indigenous women's rights. Without the reinforcement of Indigenous women's role in nation building, there is no assurance that our traditional customs, languages, and forms of governance will be perpetuated. Consequently, our identity as Indigenous peoples could be reduced to artifacts in museums. Therefore, it is important that all states practice in good faith the process of free, prior, and informed consent. And while the international community congratulates the Government of Canada for its June 11, 2008 apology to the Indian residential school survivors, there has been no change in the status quo. Poverty, inadequate housing, sexual discrimination amongst the Aboriginal population remains unchanged. Therefore, Quebec Native Women recommends to the Permanent Forum that all member states, including Canada, do the following. Create a national strategy on promoting and preventing violence against Indigenous women and children, which incorporates customary Indigenous initiatives of child care and family support. Provide public services consulted with and adapted to the Indigenous culture and traditions. That all states implement the Convention on the Rights of the Child, as well as implementing UN Declaration 21, 22, 23, and 24, inter alia, to adequately help Indigenous peoples overcome the effects of colonization. That all states implement the norm of free, prior, and informed consent, including the rights pertaining to the equality of Indigenous women. A gender-based analysis be implemented in all state policies and programs, especially those that affect the collective rights of Indigenous peoples. That access to safe water be recognized as a basic human right, and that Indigenous people have a meaningful role in the watershed protection. Ensure that states ensure that Indigenous women and their organizations will be equitably represented in the decision-making processes regarding land management and water rights. Prevent the exploitation of Indigenous lands before the settlement of land claims, and urge the few remaining states opposed to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, in particular Canada, to fully support and implement the UN Declaration. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ellen Gabrielle from North America, the Quebec Native Women's Incorporated. I'd like now to call on the representative of Finland, representative of the Finnish Sami Youth Organization.
Parra Sakni oli hetsi, arvostahtun pystyväsfoorum on telekaahta ja vassalasti. Chair, respected members of the Permanent Forum, honorable delegates and participants of the session. I have the honor to address the distinguished forum as a representative of the Finnish Sami Youth Organization and a member of the delegation of Finland. I will focus on the issues of urban Indigenous women and girls. Finland, like other countries, faces specific national challenges with reference to urbanization. The general movement of population from rural areas into cities, which was especially prevalent in the 1960s and 70s, had also an impact on the Finnish indigenous peoples, the Sami people, often better or only means of higher education and employment opportunities, push young Sami people to move to urban areas. This has an impact in particularly on the young Sami women, who are less likely to get their livelihood out of reindeer herding, a traditional Sami livelihood. About a half of the Sami people in Finland live outside of the traditional Sami homeland. The number of the Sami people living in urban areas continues to rise. We have today an increasing generation of Sami people who were born in the cities. We are only now starting to discover the new challenges this poses on preserving and building up the Sami identity and the realization of our rights. Urbanization presents a challenge to the enjoyment of the rights entitled to the indigenous peoples, especially in relation to our language and culture. These challenges are in part practical ones, but ever further, they relate to our sense of community. The question of how to best preserve the culture, identity, traditional knowledge, and cultural heritage when one is not included in the tight-knit community rises on the fore. Further, the Sami people, including the youth, need to have the right to choose on equal grounds with the rest of the population the type of education and livelihood they want to pursue. At the same time, we have the constitutional right to preserve and develop the Sami culture and languages even when located outside of the Sami homeland. To tackle these challenges, we need to first of all stress the responsibility of the state to fulfill its obligations on the rights of the Sami people in Finland, no matter where we are residing. An aspect I want to highlight is acknowledge of the history and rights of the Sami people. It is important both to the Sami people, ourselves, as well to the rest of the population. This was recognized in the government development program of child and youth policy, which was adopted on the end of the 2007. According to the program, measures to be taken include making of the Sami culture better known as part of the general education at all levels. To this end, the internet-based education material for elementary schools on the Sami culture was finalized in 2008. We need more advances in this direction. Even with these modern-day challenges, the Sami culture is being strengthened by day. It is also up to the young people to show our interest and be active on issues related to our culture and heritage. But realize these rights, we need the state, first of all, to carry out its responsibility. The role of the woman has always been central in preserving culture and heritage. This continues to be the case even if a woman and their families live in urban areas. At the same time, Sami women and girls face increasing expectation to perform well with the modern society, while at the same time preserving the identity of the traditional Sami woman. More needs to be done, including in Finland, to strengthen the gender perspective with the Sami self-governance and empower Sami women to influence the future of their people through activities both in public and private spheres. After all, families carry an essential role in the rearing of children and passing on the language and culture to the future generation. This is increasingly important as close as 70% of the Sami youth and children live outside of the traditional Sami homeland. The crucial role is also the Sami organization needs to be mentioned. They play an important part in the bringing people together and creating possibilities to strengthen the Sami culture and our sense of community. The role of Sami community, Sami parliament, and organizations at different levels, NGOs and self-governing bodies, are vital in realization of the right of the Sami people also in the urban areas. The challenges I have highlighted are important to recognize. Ways to tackle them need to be found. But I always want to bring another dimension, the role of the indigenous woman as an opportunity and a great asset. Indigenous women in urban areas represents a tremendous resource by which to further the information on the indigenous cultures and to enhance the enjoyment of the rights of the indigenous peoples. The more constructive contact there is between the indigenous peoples and the rest of the population, the better we can work together to fulfill the rights of the indigenous people. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Thomas Aslak Yuso of the Sami Finnish Sami Youth Organization. It's really a good experience to hear a young Sami man talking about Sami women. I think that is a good sign. Okay, let's move on now to the representative of the Observer Government of Spain, Ms. Dolores Martin, Director of the Indigenous Program, Spanish Agency for Cooperation and Development. You have the floor, Madam.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, members of the Permanent Forum, my delegation briefly wishes to share some information pertaining to the steps taken by the Spanish government under item 3 of the agenda. These steps fit within the third steering plan of Spanish cooperation for the period 2009-2012, upon which is based the policy of Spanish cooperation with the indigenous peoples in a commitment to fight against poverty and promote human development, with the purpose of recognizing and promoting the right of the indigenous peoples to develop their own social, economic, political, and cultural development processes. In the economic and social development field, Spain takes an approach which promotes respectful cooperation with cultures and ways of life of indigenous peoples, including those who voluntarily live in isolation and in international contact. The Spanish government is furthermore aware of the need to disseminate the recommendations of the forum among other non-governmental players. And in this regard, I'd like to refer to the organization by the Indigenous Program of the Spanish Agency for International Cooperation for Development, of an information briefing in May 2008 with the main Spanish firms who operate in Latin America. The purpose of this meeting was to promote consultations and spread the need for us to secure prior, free, informed consent of indigenous peoples in those processes which directly or indirectly affect them. Madam Chairman, over the last year, Spain has endeavored to implement the recommendations of the Permanent Forum at its seventh session, incorporating formulation of policies, knowledge, and experience of the indigenous peoples in consultation with them, protecting biological diversity, fostering management of natural resources by those peoples, and promoting measures against climate change and other environmentally related issues. With these objectives, Spain has held the second meeting, Latin American meeting of local governments in the indigenous territories, or rather it financed the holding of this event, which took place in November in Guatemala under the slogan Water, Local Development with Identity. The Spanish government will maintain its financial commitment for the third such meeting taking place in Paraguay at the end of this year. With respect to indigenous women, the recommendations of the forum pursue objectives such as an increase in participation of indigenous women. Amongst the priority measures of the Spanish government are specific support for indigenous women's organizations in the communities, support for indigenous women in the organization, gender education, sexual and reproductive health, the fight against gender violence, economic development, and all other activities which are of relevance for overcoming inequality in rights from which they may suffer in their respective social contexts. Likewise, Spain has devoted special attention to bilingual intercultural education as a key factor in the process of empowering girls and women from the indigenous peoples. It seeks to incorporate them into education, increase their personal autonomy, and make possible communication with the surrounding society. In the written contribution submitted by the Spanish government, there are more details in this regard, as well as examples of specific development projects in Ecuador and Guatemala, which may prove to be best practice for others to follow. In February of 2007, Spain ratified Convention 169 of the ILO on indigenous and tribal peoples in independent countries. 2 years later, the Spanish Agency for International Cooperation has just published a report on the implications of ratification and implementation of this convention for Spanish policy. Therefore, our delegation has pleasure in inviting you to the presentation of this report in the context of the Permanent Forum next Thursday from 1 to 3 p.m. in the conference room in the DC2 building. Thank you very much, Madam.
I would like to thank the representative of the Observer Government of Spain, Ms. Dolores Martin, Director of the Indigenous Program, Spanish Agency for Cooperation and Development. Thank you very much. I know that the AECI now has increased its funding for indigenous peoples, and I would like to express our gratitude to you for increasing that kind of contribution. I would like now to call on the representative of the International Organization for Migration, Mr. Luca Dall'Oglio. Yes, Amy Mudin. Okay, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson, and I am delivering this statement on behalf of IOM's permanent observer, Mr. Luca Dall'Oglio. Madam Chairperson, distinguished members of the Permanent Forum, delegates, ladies and gentlemen, and colleagues, it is an honor and a great pleasure for the International Organization for Migration to address the Permanent Forum here today under the agenda item Urban Indigenous Women and Migration because of the important role of Indigenous women and the challenges and opportunities they face during the migration process. In March 2007, IOM participated in an expert group meeting on urban indigenous peoples and migration in Santiago, Chile, to discuss the challenges of improving the quality of life of urban indigenous peoples and the ongoing rural urban migration process. Amongst the various conclusions of that meeting, it was noted that while the migration and urbanization experience for indigenous peoples is not a homogeneous one, a closer examination of the experience for indigenous women illustrated their particular vulnerabilities. In Asia, for example, it was highlighted that indigenous migrant women are particularly affected by the negative sides of urbanization and need special support, including protection against physical and emotional harassment, and to counter the risk of being lured into human trafficking networks. In addition, previous sessions of the Permanent Forum have raised concerns regarding the migration of indigenous women, in particular regarding difficulties related to their integration into societies of destination. A recent desk review of human development reports and indigenous peoples undertaken by the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum further demonstrates indigenous women as one of the most vulnerable groups of society, leading to their marginalization and their social exclusion. However, it is also important to note that some indigenous peoples do move to urban areas because of several factors relating to employment and educational prospects and opportunities, improved access to health and housing services, and also increased political participation, social recognition, and visibility or other opportunities that they may lack in their native communities. Indigenous peoples have acknowledged that urbanization often becomes their only modality to ensure the survival of the traditional way of life in their territories through urban-rural remittances. In this context, it is important to realize that those indigenous peoples migrating to urban centers do not leave their identity behind and must not be artificially divided into urban and rural members of indigenous peoples. Their rights and identity should be considered wholly, irrespective of whether they live on their territories or in urban areas. Madam Chairperson, according to UN estimates, 2008 marked the first year in human history where there were more urban dwellers than rural inhabitants. Given the lack of statistical and socio-demographic data, it is unclear how many of the nearly 200 million migrants in the world today represent indigenous women, and we have limited information on their migration process. Even less information is available on indigenous women's migration to urban areas. This scarcity of data prevents adequate policymaking on migration issues with regard to indigenous peoples, specifically indigenous women, as they face important challenges that have specific peculiarities which relate to the ties to their ancestral territories. While indigenous migrant women face many of the same challenges as non-indigenous migrant women, their vulnerability is compounded by discrimination as migrants and as women, as well as for being indigenous peoples. For these reasons, policies, programs, or legislation designed to protect the rights of migrant women are often ineffective for indigenous migrant women unless their indigenous status is explicitly recognized and addressed. To do so, programs, service delivery guidelines, and policies should facilitate the systematic integration of culturally relevant gender-based analysis specific to the needs of indigenous women. For its part, IOM is paying special attention to these considerations in the promotion and delivery of migration-related programs, for instance, in designing and implementing its counter-trafficking program in Ecuador to respond to the particular needs of indigenous victims of trafficking. These activities are developed and implemented within a human rights framework centered on the concern for the well-being of the victim. In implementing this program, several panels and workshops were organized to learn from the experience of indigenous professionals working in related fields, and an indigenous consultant was hired to plan and carry out this program with an intercultural focus. In conclusion, IOM looks forward to continued cooperation and collaboration with interested stakeholders engaged on migration, including on promoting the views and concerns of indigenous peoples on these matters and hopes for a successful session of this year's Permanent Forum. Thank you, Madam Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Amy Mudin from the International Organization on Migration. I'd like to call now on Delaria Baba Festus, who is from the Kwatusan Culture and Education Center. Is Delaria in the room? No? I'll call now on Sarah Fortune, who is from the International Tuareg. Yes, please, you take the...
Tchoulawen, Wulen, Wulen, Felawen. Ce qui veut dire bonjour.
That means hello, sisters and brothers. And I'm sorry for the interpreters, because to stick within the 3 minutes, I'll have to make certain cuts to the text. So I'd like the interpreters to stick to what I've said rather than what I wrote. The interpreter points out she doesn't even have the text in the first place, so that doesn't make much difference. So what I wanted to do was speak about the condition, the status of Tuareg women. Tuareg women are matriarchal figures. They're the pillars of the family in Mali, Morocco. Indigenous issues are very much the concern of civil society organizations and politicians, as well as our international partners, of course. The problem of improving the living conditions of women is the priority concern of national authorities in certain cases, but sometimes it's not the case. It's true that this is the main issue here is that of urban women, but as far as nomadic women, who account for 85% of the population, only 15% are in urban areas. As far as Niger is concerned, that is the reality. So now I'll move straight to the recommendations on this specific issue. And I must confess that all of the conventional recommendations about capacity building of indigenous peoples, the declaration on the rights of indigenous peoples, and various international instruments for the indigenous populations, as far as they're concerned, I must confess they only interest a tiny portion of the Tuareg peoples outside the cities, just a tiny, minuscule party, just 15% of the population. However, we have capacities which are our own ones and which have allowed us to live for years and years in a more than arid area, and you can help us to protect them by protecting our habitats, which have been the subject of conflicts which have constantly upsurged, including today, and they give rise to disasters. Women are the prime victims of these disasters. Their lives are imperiled and their husbands and children are killed. And for the oldest, they're the breadwinners. So these people are killed by the military junta. There's radiological contamination of our areas as well, which has given rise to health needs, which are not meeting a proper response in terms of infrastructure. This reality is denied by health workers paid for by the mining industry. So we want an external independent body to draw up a report specifically on the health of populations in the north of Niger. And through your body, we'd also like to raise the question of demilitarization of this area to allow for a free exchange, re-movement of people looking for pasture land. We'd also like to see a food bank which will allow women to feed their children through the milk they produce. We also want special protection and support for water in our region, as well as the involvement of civil society and women's organizations with respect to decision-making in these areas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sarah Fortune. I now call on Dot Henry, who will speak on behalf of the National Native Title Council, Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission Australia, among other organizations. Dot Henry, you have the floor.
Madam Chair, this intervention is presented on behalf of the Australian Caucus of Non-Government Organisations. In keeping with Indigenous protocol, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land we are meeting on. Indigenous women continue to survive and nurture their families and communities despite the multiple violations affecting their physical, emotional and social well-being. The most insidious violations experienced by Indigenous women in Australia stem from a history of policies and practices imposed by successive governments that have ignored and undermined maternal, cultural, social, economic and basic human rights. All levels of government in Australia have been called upon to address the unresolved injustices that have contributed to the erosion of the foundations of families and gender roles. Indigenous women continue to strive for an existence comparable to that enjoyed by other Australians, particularly in the areas of reducing the incidence of violence, increasing opportunities to overcome poverty, reducing recidivism and re-victimisation by the criminal justice system, improving educational outcomes at all levels, raising adequate standard of housing, gaining health equality, and strengthening the voices of Indigenous women in political decision making. Our men and women have called on governments to develop holistic approaches for appropriate education, essential services and culturally appropriate justice, which are central to the elimination of discrimination and violence against women and children. Whilst we acknowledge that Australia has agreed to support the declaration, we note Article 22 calls for attention to the rights and special needs of Indigenous women. The participation of Indigenous women in the pursuit of these objectives is essential to any success in achieving them. There is a high demand for access to justice through specialised legal aid services for Indigenous women. The Australian Government has endeavoured to address these needs by setting up family violence prevention units and legal services and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women's legal services and advocacy programs. However, resources need to be adequately allocated for these services to have any meaningful impact. In Australia, there are few, if any, state services to respond to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, FASD. Consequently, individuals are primarily cared for at home by mothers, grandmothers and great-grandmothers. We welcome the national apology to the stolen generations. While this has been a momentous moment, there needs to be a momentous movement that demonstrates to all Australians how the government intends to give meaning and life to the spirit of the national apology and the recent endorsement of the declaration. We, the Australian Caucus members, recommend that this UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues supports the following. 1. All states cease policies and practices that deny Indigenous women access to services that address their emotional and social well-being. 2. All states must appropriately fund specific services to assist Indigenous women to access social and family violence prevention legal services, legal aid, redress and compensation. These services must be provided in urban, rural and remote locations. 3. We urge all states to implement their duties under the Declaration with particular regard to the establishment of national Indigenous women's advocacy bodies that represent the voices and interests of Indigenous women. 4. Indigenous women call upon states to support lifelong service delivery responses for people affected by fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Dot Henry, representing various Australian Indigenous organizations. I'd like now to call on the representative of the Observer Government of Guatemala, Mr. Marco Antonio Curuchic, the Commissioner of the Presidential Commission on the Fight Against Racism and Discrimination. Mr. Curuchic, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Once again, my delegation would like to greet you and the other members of the forum and congratulate you on your re-election as chair of this session. We would like to say thank you for this opportunity to refer specifically to the application of the recommendations established in previous fora with regards to Indigenous women. We are concerned that in the analysis prepared by the Secretariat, 46% of recommendations have not yet been implemented or else there is no information about that implementation. We recognise the need to have the necessary financial resources to continue with the implementation of those recommendations because this is a stumbling block for that. My delegation would like to inform the forum of the progress made in Guatemala and in the defence of indigenous women, which is the body that works to define, develop and implement actions, strategies and processes for the recognition, respect, promotion and compliance of indigenous women's rights and their impact in public policies and draft bills. That is support for public policies and laws in favour of indigenous women, debate, analysis of diagnosis, research programmes and consultations in favour of women, indigenous women and peoples, participation in the review of the public policy proposal of attention for migrants, especially for indigenous peoples, and we also undertook a process of training and communication to prevent violence against women. We facilitated the articulated agenda of Mayan, Garifunas and Xinka women. Different women's leaders and representatives participated in this alongside state institutions. The articulated agenda includes and covers the main proposal and demands of the organizations of Maya, Garifunas and Xinka women in order to contribute to improving their living conditions. The aim is to raise the profile of the specific situation of exclusion and discrimination against indigenous women and to foster gender equality and respect for their cultural identity in order to improve their quality of life in the public and private sphere, based on the implementation by the state of cross-cutting strategies and thematic strategies. The Defence for Indigenous Women's Body developed a model of attention, advice and monitoring of indigenous women who suffered violation of their rights, providing them with social, psychological and free legal advice in their mother tongue and is based on cultural elements of indigenous peoples. Social care. In this unit, we approach the user to become familiar with her problems and to provide her with specific care for her needs. It covers protection measures by the right bodies and in those cases that require mediation, conciliation or transferring the case to a court so that women can have greater capacity for denunciation. We also provide psychological care. We have specific psychological care, taking into account the culture of indigenous women whose basic rights have been infringed, specifically in intrafamily violence. We implement basic guidelines from indigenous cosmovision to promote the prevention and revindication of cultural values and principles contributing to improving their quality of life. The most recent action was the launch of the campaign on promoting the rights of indigenous women that took place on 13th of March 2009 in coordination with the Defence of Indigenous Women, the Presidential Commission Against Discrimination and Racism Against Indigenous Peoples in Guatemala and the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Guatemala. The national campaign for living together in cultural diversity includes actions in the social media to boost a process of systematic awareness in the dissemination of messages directed at the population of Guatemala for coexistence in cultural diversity. Its main aims are to increase the awareness of the society of Guatemala to eliminate racism and discrimination, to generate opinions and a change in attitudes towards the Xinka, Garifuna, Maya, and Mestizo peoples for a happier social coexistence. The aim is to increase the profile of the racial discrimination, ethnic and gender discrimination suffered by indigenous peoples, especially women, and to promote cultural elements of the Maya, Xinka, Garifuna peoples for the acknowledgement and valuation of their national identity. We are aware of the value and cultural diversity that indigenous people contribute to the universal heritage of humanity, and we acknowledge their active participation in society is fundamental to consolidate the political and social stability of the countries in which they live. In October 2006, we launched the public policy for coexistence and the elimination of racism and racial discrimination. This policy is a joint effort of public and private institutions, social scientists, activists and grassroots organizations concerned about eradicating the insidious problem of racism, convinced that Guatemalan society and Guatemala as a country can move from exclusion and discrimination to a reality based on pluralism and democracy. To conclude, Madam Chair, my delegation would like to reaffirm its backing and support for the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, and we encourage all its members, the member states, the UN system agencies, non-governmental organizations, and civil society to continue working together so that this forum will achieve its aims and will meet the Millennium Development Goals. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank the representative of the Observer Government of Guatemala. I'd like now to call on the representative of the International Union for Conservation of Nature, Annelie Fink. Oh, it's Gonzalo Oviedo. You have the floor, Gonzalo.
Muchas gracias, señora presidenta.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The role of indigenous women is of great importance in conserving biodiversity of ecosystems and the resources for indigenous peoples, as they are the guardians and those who pass on ancestral knowledge about natural resources. However, indigenous women are usually excluded and lacking in opportunities, and they are specifically vulnerable to the degradation of nature and the impact of climate change, for example, with regards to lack of water, food insecurity, and many other extremes. We wish to promote the equality of indigenous women as a way to boost conservation, including access and use of resources, awareness of their traditional uses, the increased benefits of participation in decision-making. The knowledge of indigenous women should be included in decision-making capacities, especially regarding access to land and other natural resources, and problem-solving, food security during difficult economic and weather periods. I would also like to mention the Gender Equality Program of IUCN, which has been working alongside the Convention on Biodiversity. Last year, the Secretariat and the IUCN organized a workshop with representatives of Indigenous women and gender experts and local communities to explore the main linkages between biodiversity and gender equality to ascertain the role of the convention in terms of making progress towards gender equality. We prepared an analysis of gender mainstreaming in biodiversity, and we developed a gender action plan that was approved by the Conference of the Parties in May 2008. Another workshop was organized for capacity building in Indigenous women with regards to the Convention on Biodiversity, and this too was approved. In regional work on Indigenous peoples in Latin America, the IUCN is committed to boosting capacity building for Indigenous women. We provide technical assistance to the Latin American Network of Indigenous Women and Biodiversity. We invited them to our World Conference in October last year, and we stressed the importance of greater representation of Indigenous women in many different events and debates. A series of national workshops organized by IUCN throughout Central and South America enabled us to identify the needs of Indigenous women and what to do to improve capacity building and their participation in decision making. The result was a publication which is part of a regional agenda focusing on strategies to boost the role of Indigenous women. Next month, the IUCN and the Indigenous peoples of Mesoamerica will be organizing a workshop on climate change and Indigenous women in Honduras. Madam Chair, IUCN repeats the need to stress gender equality in sustainable development and to increase the capacity of Indigenous women to participate in the decision-making process linked to natural resources and their benefits to achieve better results in guaranteeing their rights, reducing poverty, and improving the quality of life of the women, their families, and their communities. IUCN will continue to contribute towards this and will work with counterparties in order to improve the integration of Indigenous women in decision-making processes, and we will closely monitor all of this within the Permanent Forum. Thank you very much.
Gonzalo Oviedo of the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. I'd like to call now on Beverly Jacobs, after which I'll call on Jennifer Awingan. Beverly Jacobs, you have the floor.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairperson. First, the analysis that was undertaken by yourself and the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, on specifically on Indigenous women, is an important framework from which to advance the human rights of Indigenous women. The four categories that were provided is a way to organize national action plans for states. Firstly, I have a very strong comment to make to Canada, and we continue to make these kinds of statements in Canada and internationally. While we as Indigenous women do have individual rights, our rights stem from our nationhood and from our creation stories. It is a result of the genocidal and assimilationist policies of Canada that we as Indigenous women have to deal with the various barriers and impacts of colonization today. I have been told quite consistently by Indigenous women in Canada that they come from nations, that they want their homes and their communities to be safe and healthy, and they cannot separate themselves individually from their nationhood. Most recently, NWAC publicized its Voices of Our Sisters in Spirit report regarding missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada. The high rates of violence facing Indigenous women in all walks of life, within the community, within their home, within urban centers, and within the larger society, requires a systemic response. The following are some brief stats from that report. As of March 31, 2009, the estimated number of missing or murdered Aboriginal women in Canada since 1970 is 520. 347 of these 520, 67% have been murdered. 126 remain missing. 233 women have gone missing since the year 2000. 150 of the 346 murder cases remain unsolved. And 52% of the missing women were under the age of 30 at the time of their disappearances. And we have identified next steps for the Sisters in Spirit. There is a critical need for a national plan of action to stop all forms of violence against Indigenous women and girls, regardless of where they live. Such a plan of action must include provisions to ensure collection and dissemination of information on the identity of Indigenous victims of crime, identity of perpetrators of crime, clear protocols and guidelines to ensure effective and appropriate responses by police and the justice system as a whole, and measures to address the underlying systemic conditions that perpetuate this problem, including discrimination, poverty, and low socioeconomic status. There are two recommendations from the UPR process that we want to highlight. One is a recommendation from Norway, and that they recommend a comprehensive reporting and statistical analysis of the scale and character of violence against Indigenous women so that a national strategy can be initiated in consultation with Indigenous representatives to respond to the severity of the issues. A recommendation by the Czech Republic. They recommended adopting further measures to ensure accountability of the police for their proper, sensitive, and effective conduct in cases of violence against women, and better protection of Aboriginal women against all violence. There were also key recommendations in CEDAW that were specific to the missing and murdered Aboriginal women in Canada, and its recommendations to report a detailed analysis and thorough investigations into the disappearances and murders of Indigenous women within 1 year. And this would be this fall, 2009. So we, as an organization, recommend very key recommendations to Canada, this national action plan, better guidance and accountability for police, consistent and thorough collection of statistical data, improved measures to close the gap in the standard of living between Indigenous women and others in Canadian society, including housing, employment, education, and health. Also, we support the report of recommendations from the International Indigenous Women's Forum on the analysis and follow-up of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues recommendations related to Indigenous women. Also, that Canada make a commitment to the UPR process and that they report on what they're asking for. A written update on the steps to implement the recommendations related to the critical human rights issues facing Indigenous women. And we also call on relevant UN bodies and agencies, states and Indigenous peoples to conduct their own assessments of the extent to which they have advanced the recommendations of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous women, utilizing the framework of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as also set out by the International Indigenous Women's Forum. And that there has to be action for immediate implementation of these recommendations as required by all. Yawa, thank you.
Thank you very much, Beverly Jacobs, and also for the update on the situation of the missing women of the Aboriginal women in Canada. I'd like now to call on Jennifer Awingan, who will speak on behalf of the Forum for Indigenous Perspectives and Action in Manipur, Asia Pacific Indigenous Youth, and other organizations. Yes, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Jennifer Awingan. I am presenting the joint statement of 9 Indigenous organizations who come from Asia, North and Latin America, Pacific, Africa, and the Caribbean. We welcome the analysis report prepared by the Secretariat of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues on Indigenous Women, outlined in Section 2D of the report E/C/19/2009/8. Particularly the Permanent Forum's recommendation to integrate the special needs and concerns of Indigenous women into their programs and policies by compiling and integrating disaggregated data on Indigenous women's issues. We express our concern, particularly on Indigenous women's situation in conflict-ridden regions where states' violence against women and children forced their migration. We therefore call for the Permanent Forum to recommend to states and United Nations agencies to include in their data collection and holding of workshop the specific impacts of armed conflicts, military occupation, and military activities in indigenous lands, people's lands, and territories on indigenous women and their migration to other areas. Such migration in other areas, including in urban areas, have further led to violence and discrimination against indigenous women and children. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for also being brief. Thank you. I'd like now to call on Kathleen McHugh, and after her, Dennis Volant. So Kathleen McHugh. McHugh, you have the floor. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. Honorable Permanent Forum members, distinguished delegates, and Indigenous representatives, I make this intervention as member of the Assembly of First Nations Women's Council, and as such, I am also representing the Assembly of First Nations and its National Chief, Phil Fontaine. I want to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Onondaga Nation, whose territory we are meeting on today. We take this opportunity to draw attention to the Government of Canada's proposed legislation that is currently being considered by Canada's Parliament. First Nations, including First Nations women, strongly oppose the proposed Bill C-8 legislation, which deals with matrimonial real property on reserves in Canada. We call on all opposition parties and the federal government to support the Hoist motion to not send Bill C-8 for further consideration in legislative committee. We call on Canada to consult with First Nations in Canada in a manner that fully respects its treaty and constitutional obligations and fully responds to the goals, needs, and rights of First Nations women, families, and citizens in Canada. Any proposed legislation dealing with First Nations must be done in full consultation with First Nations. Contrary to Canada's assertions today regarding consultations, this bill does not have our free, prior, and informed consent, and our opinions and perspectives are not reflected in this bill. We ask that Canada reconsider moving forward with any legislative initiative that has been developed without full respect for its legal obligations to consult and accommodate First Nations rights and interests, or without the free, prior, and informed consent of First Nations as required by Article 18 and 19, as well as Articles 3, 4, 5, 6, and 18 of the UN Declaration. Since the inception of the United Nations, Indigenous women have inspired and nurtured the work of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Indigenous women from all over the world have played an exceptional role in shaping its voice and vision. Indigenous women have figured prominently in the work of the Indigenous Caucus, including drafting of the UN Declaration, and Indigenous women will be instrumental in guiding its implementation. We must continue to promote, protect, and broaden the role that Indigenous women play and the remarkable opportunity to restore balance once again in our families and nations. With respect to the report of the expert group meeting on the role of the UN Permanent Forum in the implementation of Article 42 of the UN Declaration, the AFN Women's Council emphasizes, number one, our support for the recommendations made under paragraph 64 of the report, especially that states should, in the spirit of harmonious and cooperative relationships with the Indigenous peoples, establish as soon as possible, where it does not already exist, a national dialogue with Indigenous peoples on human rights based on the Declaration. Two, the AFN Women's Council also supports recommendations made under paragraph 65 of the report, especially that the Secretary General should provide an adequate budget for the purpose of meeting requirements of Article 42 of the Declaration, as it may apply to the Permanent Forum, its Secretariat, and relevant actions. The AFN Women's Council also submits two key recommendations for the report of the UN Permanent Forum Expert Group and the implementation of Article 42 of the UN Declaration. Number one, the AFN Women's Council recommends that in the implementation of Article 42, of the declaration and regarding our support for paragraph 65 of the report of the expert group that the UN Permanent Forum should adopt and apply culturally relevant gender balance analyses in promoting respect for the full application of the provisions of the declaration, including meaningful and effective follow-up. And two, the AFN Women's Council recommends that in the implementation of Article 42 of the UN Declaration, and regarding our support for paragraph 65 of the report of the expert group, that the Secretary General should support and promote special budgeting considerations to gender, children, and youth for the purpose of meeting requirements of Article 42 of the Declaration. The goal of our recommendations is to ensure Indigenous women are true partners in implementing the Declaration, and that any barriers preventing their full and equal participation at this international, at the international, state, and local levels are identified and removed. We wish to ensure Indigenous women have equal consideration and are equally protected through inclusion of, in advocacy efforts. Culturally relevant gender balance analyses and gender budgeting are critical to ensuring the knowledge, traditions, and vital expertise of Indigenous women are considered in the full application of the provisions of this declaration. Both of our recommendations are critical in achieving the UN Millennium Development Goal of promoting gender equality and the empowerment of women in all our work. Thank you.
Thank you. The next speaker is Dennis Barant from Inuit Nation. Please, you have the floor. Dennis Barant is here.
Yes. Kwe, aîné, délégué des peuples autochtones, membre de l'instance permanente sur les questions.
Delegates and Indigenous people, representatives of governments, thank you for giving us this opportunity to enrich your discussions. This second decade for Indigenous peoples should allow the top level four of the United Nations to consider members of the Indigenous communities as human beings, fully fledged human beings. In my mother tongue, we are called Innu, which means human beings in our language. And I speak on behalf of the First Nation of Innu in the northeast of Canada. Our ancestral land is called Intanasanan, which means our land. The Educational Cultural Institute Matinera Sam, which is the organization for which I work in the language field, as well as culture and education, is one example of our institutions. For more than 100 years now, we have been developing our work in the arboreal forests, more than 500 kilometers from the closest town. Our forefathers handed on the knowledge and traditions required for the survival of their coming generations. Then there was colonial expansion, the arrival of mining and forest companies, the creation of reservations. All of these seriously affected our way of life. Traditional transmission of Innu values and knowledge suddenly stopped, with a new form of teaching and pedagogy being introduced, with a new form of teaching world history, which was alien to our culture. This brief history does not differ from that of other First Nations in Canada. Indeed, the Prime Minister of Canada, Stephen Harper, publicly apologized in 2008 on behalf of the Canadian people and confessed that the Canadian state had planned to assimilate the Indigenous peoples and had failed lamentably. Notwithstanding his apology, he has still not signed the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which has already been ratified by many other countries. Today, we still have problems with schooling our children. The minister makes us feel that we are responsible for our own educational results. But how can we achieve better results when funding is so scant? A recent study undertaken by our organization clearly calls for a school run by the First Nation to receive funding of 30% of the 30% shortfall which exists between funding currently in our schools compared to Canadian conventional schools. And this backlog in our development has a direct influence on our life. We call for fairness vis-à-vis the provinces with respect to educational funding. Secondly, we want to see the development of a curriculum which includes linguistic and cultural phenomena as indicated in the Royal fact-finding survey carried out a few years ago. Our economic and social development is contingent on education. The representative of Canada said we have developed two new programs for Indigenous peoples, which only goes to show that the Canadian government is continuing its assimilation policy. Subsequently, there needs to be the funding of a symposium for building capacity and skills and a symposium on education. Notwithstanding all the problems which can be ascribed to education, it's only through education that Indigenous peoples can stand on their own two feet, educationally, culturally and politically. These are the things which would allow young Indigenous people to achieve real. So interruption from the chair, could you please sum up? Thank you for your attention. Let us hope to see Canada signing the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples with respect, dignity and honour as soon as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Nate Sid Kamira. Please, you have the floor. Is Nate Sid Kamira?
Yes, she's right there.
Nate Sid Kamira.
Yes.
Okay, please, you have the floor.
Hello. Madame la Présidente.
Madam Chairperson, sisters and brothers, good afternoon. I'd like to introduce a report on women in Algeria and in all of the region, particularly Kabyle women. Our women are doubly aggressed in the community and in our linguistic and cultural identity. Not only do we need to fight to secure our legitimate rights, but we also need to fight against the predominant Arab Muslim culture. Amazigh women are the victims of laws and traditions which are especially sexist, which make men apparently superior. There is a text derived from the Sharia, and it is still in force to enshrine inequality between women and men. Although Algeria has ratified the Convention on Elimination of Discrimination against Women, this legal discrimination still has very solid champions in the most conservative strata of Amazigh society and in Islamic fundamentalism. A stock taking today shows that Amazigh women are far from being respected in terms of their legitimate rights. She's aggressed verbally, physically, symbolically, mentally and legally in her daily lives. Amazigh women in their old customs were respected as wives and women, but today they're relegated to a derisory status, losing respect in their communities. They need to take part in the decisions relating to their families and ownership and education. Women always had the right of preserving the cultural traditions of their peoples. They always took active part in active decision-making. In ancient times, Amazigh women had an important place in society. Often they were at the heads of kingdoms, for example, in Kabylia. And they're still the pride of the Kabyle people and the Amazigh people. The concern of Kabyle elders is such that the male and female worlds have always been separated, but women were always respected in this traditional society. When the particularly critical situation affected women during the serious drought, we called for rains, and if there were curses, then it was the women who would call for blessings. Women always had an important role in conflicts between tribes as well. Often tribes sent women's delegations to try to negotiate peace, and often did so with success. Amasya women are well known for their strong character and refusal to bend. They're equal to men and today as well, and they continue to fight against the Algerian family code in Algeria, which is essentially inspired by Sharia law. Some examples of this are the associations of women and children who are denouncing crimes against women, interruption from the chair. Kabyle women have constantly fought to have their rights respected. Amasya women have fought so hard. Traditional systems have always been unequal, and we've always fought against them when faced with the constraints imposed upon us by Arab Islamic regimes ever since the independence of Algeria. Men in the regime stopped women from participating. They didn't want us involved. Amasya women, another interruption from the chair. Notwithstanding all these obstacles, the Amasya women in Algeria and the whole area have gained some ground over recent years, thanks to their struggle. In Algeria, we've managed to secure an amendment to the family code. And after these amendments, it's clear that it now needs to be repealed altogether and replaced by a truly egalitarian law. We need to emancipate ourselves from these medieval mentalities which try to keep us in a state of slavery and enslavement. Another interruption from the chair.
Ya se ha terminado su tiempo.
Your time is up, says the chair. Please sum up.
Je vais résumer.
Well, I'll sum up then. The recommendations for Kabyle women. We call for autonomy of the Kabylie region so that women can recover their rights and establish civil laws which are egalitarian. We also call on the Algerian government to respect the Declaration, Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and the respect for the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women and the lifting of all their reservations. We want a consensus-based future which promotes the status of women, a policy for promoting women's employment, strengthening equal opportunity and cultural change that will take us out of a state of isolation. Another interaction from the chair. We want to see a dialogue between institutions of civil society, especially with women's institutions. Thank you, madam.
Thank you. The next speaker is Tarsila Rivera, the Enlace Continental de Mujeres Indígenas Región Sudamérica. Please, you have the floor. Is Ms. Tarsila Rivera here? Please, okay. You have the floor.
Buenas tardes.
Good afternoon. I'm going to read a statement. Madam Chairman, brothers and sisters in the Indigenous Forum of the United Nations, I'm Maria Cecina Pocaterra La Paz. I'm an Indigenous woman living in El Salvador. I'm a Venezuelan citizen. I also work to fund my studies. Chairman Victoria Talis-Kopus and other members of the Permanent Forum, brothers and sisters, I belong to the Network of Indigenous Women, WAYU of Venezuela, which is the grassroots organization of the National Indian Council of Venezuela and a member of the Continental Liaison Organization for Indigenous Women in the Americas. I bring to you a cordial welcome from the WAYU people and from our coordinator's office, Noeli Pocaterra, who sends you a fraternal greeting. It's the first time I've taken part in this forum, and it's an honor for me to be at this tribune for Indigenous peoples, where we speak and listen to our demands, complaints and aspirations. We can break the silence and barriers which have been imposed upon us in other areas. I speak Indigenous women and young women for South America and Mexico. We are in the middle of the second decade of Indigenous peoples, and we've seen that most states have only minimally implemented the actions required for the Indigenous peoples. We therefore urge governments to make an effort so that in the time remaining before the conclusion of this second decade, they implement more rigorously their obligations to Indigenous peoples. So we make the following recommendations. Indigenous women have been violated by discrimination and racism. We know that still we have to strengthen our pride in being Indigenous and reduce our shame because of our ethnicity, strengthen our identities in Indigenous women. It's very different in our community compared to elsewhere in the city where we're discriminated against. Therefore, we want our governments to comply with the agenda and the commitments established in the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is another achievement of Indigenous resistance, because for more than 20 years we moved to approve this declaration, and there are still some countries which have not yet adopted it. We must insist that each one of our governments promotes the Declaration of Indigenous Peoples within our states. We must gradually continue to create multicultural and multilingual states. In the countries of our sub-region, the states are colonial, and they have development models based on extraction of natural resources. We know that as Indigenous people, we need to contribute more to ensure that we create a way of life which respects Mother Earth. So we need to promote thinking and the fight against racial discrimination, as well as strengthening of the identity of our peoples and reduce our sense of shame. States must foster bilingual intercultural education, which includes Indigenous traditions and worldviews, the formation and training of girls and boys and young people with respect for nature. The states must create support policies for the young Indigenous men and women, since many of them, especially women, are involved in prostitution, drugs, and crime. And some of them even resort to self-destructive practices such as suicide. There's a need to promote programs of exchanges between Indigenous and non-Indigenous young people in order to foster interculturalism. Public policies must incorporate interculturality, recognizing the participation of different Indigenous peoples in various bodies. Madam Chairman, brothers and sisters, we'd like to thank our ancestors and our leaders for helping me to be here today, and therefore I'd like to be able to continue in this formative process. That's all. Thank you, distinguished brothers and sisters of the forum. Thank you very much. Xia Ni Tian.
Yes, Maria.
The chair, thank you. Maria Susana.
From Autonomia Iraiki. Smiley's here. You have the floor.
Milesker lehendakaria gurgarria, egunon deneri. Ore handirekin itzartzen dugu jatorrizko herrien asamblada horretan Euskal Herriko gazteriaren egoera aipatzeko zuen aintzinean. Bonjour à tous.
Good afternoon. We extend respectful greetings to the Indigenous peoples, and we warmly thank the chair for giving us this opportunity to speak on behalf of the Basque people. As a young Indigenous person from the northern Basque country, I'm aware that I have a special responsibility of conveying to coming generations our identity through learning of our language, our culture, our values, and our history. So I'd like to challenge you about the future of my people. My people is divided between two states, which are amongst the most powerful in the world, France and Spain. I belong to the northern Basque country, the territory of which fits within a country which was the founding country of human rights, the rights of man, and which signed the Charter for the Protection of Minority Peoples. However, not only is the situation of the Basque people not improving, but it's even getting worse in various regards, since France continues to consider that it has no Indigenous peoples on its mainland. The Basque people is the oldest people in Europe. The Basque people is distinctive in terms of its language and the number of cultural traits. The Basque people exists and has always upheld its specificity and always called for the implementation of the most fundamental rights, in return for which it has been repressed and has been the subject of tremendous suffering. We have continued our fight to ensure that we're still known about and still visible. The lack of recognition, the lack of our own institution in the Basque Country impairs our situation in various ways. Indeed, depending on institutions of the French state, especially in terms of education, we suffer from not being able to follow all our studies in Basque and in the Basque country. Most of the youngsters are forced to leave our country in order to carry out our secondary studies. Thus, we have to leave our families to pursue our studies. We have to leave our families. We have to forsake our own country. We therefore move away from the social, cultural, economic, and political life of our country. When we come back with our degrees to build a new life on our lands, we have new obstacles facing us. The tourism policy which has been established, as well as the policies to stimulate the colonization of our territories by elderly, affluent elderly people from France, means that the price of our land has shot up and land speculation, property speculation has become much worse. This means that a young Basque has no chance of being able to have any property on his territory. It makes it very difficult even for him to rent a property. The Lauretac Association has worked to denounce the seriousness of the housing situation in the Basque Country and has seen that a couple which has a monthly salary in excess of the minimum wage in France cannot build or buy housing without incurring a mortgage for some 30 years. And this is a situation made even worse now because of the economic crisis hitting the country. France inflicts upon us a policy of territorial manipulation, fostering leisure and luxury property projects in cooperation with property developers who have very few scruples, neglecting the fact that the right to housing is the right of all and is one of the main needs of the Basque people. We deplore the fact that all our requests for recognition are neglected, ignored, or even held against us. We deplore the fact that the so-called independent press defends the interests of the French state by disseminating a cartoon-like caricature image of our people, as if we were all terrorists, thus discrediting any autonomy or independence-based claims, and leave us the objects of mere folklore. And we call for action to be taken to stop this attempt to annihilate our people. We also need to fight against a constant criminalization of the acts of Basque civil society, because a Basque patriot who militates for the safeguarding of identity, culture, or language is very often the subject of prosecution, the aim of which is to deter us, and also it involves heavy penalties being imposed upon us for such activities. In the field of law enforcement, we're also innocent bystanders, often caught up in police operations by Spain and France. Very often, we are deported to Spain, and even though torture is still practiced in Spanish prisons. And in conclusion, if we exist in France, it's only so that we are considered to be French, and we have no institutional recognition. We have no property, and our image is distorted, manipulated. The French state ignores the reality of the different peoples living on its territory, claiming that France is an indivisible state. And yet we exist and we wish to live. So we call on the Permanent Forum kindly to take on board our claims and to bring to France's attention the existence of an indigenous Basque people on its territory, reminding it of its rights and commitments, and to appoint an expert for the Western European region. Thank you very much. And thank you, says the speaker in Basque.
Thank you, Melis. The next speaker will be being Theasa Margaret Connolly from the Retrieve Foundation. Is she here? Please raise your hand. Okay. You have the floor, madam.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chairman, for this opportunity and congratulations on your election. I carry two very important messages at this time. My name is Margaret Connolly, Indigenous and spiritual leader from Ireland. I am known to the Zulu nation as Nolzwani. Now, the Honourable Credo Mutwa, the spiritual leader of the Zulu nation and South Africa, has asked me to present the following message to this distinguished forum. Our nation is dying. Our people and their indigenous ways are being eroded. The man-made virus of HIV is wiping out our African nation. Our indigenous knowledge of herbal medicine is effective in curing AIDS. I and other Sangomas have witnessed the cure for many, many people who suffered from HIV because of our traditional healing. Yet our herbal medicines have been totally undermined by the multinational pharmaceutical companies and the fundamentalist churches. I, Credo Mutwa, am dying from poison sent to me by a German doctor to silence my voice on this matter. My life is ending and is of little importance now, but I ask for help in the name of the children and of my people. The African nation has so much knowledge to offer the world in tackling climate change and diseases. Who does it serve to keep the African nation sick? I mandate to this Indigenous Forum to please send a representative to visit me as soon as possible to assess the Indigenous African solution to this scourge of HIV. Is there anyone listening? Please heed my request. Balance. The second is the rainbow prophecies. This is the second message. It has been asked that everyone throughout the world light a sacred fire at dawn on the ninth day of the ninth month of this year, 2009. This is to fulfill the sacred rainbow prophecies. This sacred fire is to heal the DNA of ancestral memory of past trauma experienced throughout the world by colonization, conversion, and fear. For the next 19 generations will not carry this trauma through their DNA. This transformation will return a collective memory to healing, peace, and enlightenment. This sacred fire is of the utmost importance, so much so that all the technologies available today has been funneled into one space, peacefire.net. This is the first time that it has been attempted throughout the world. It is an unprecedented in our history. I implore all those to join us in lighting the sacred fire on this day, the ninth day of the ninth month in 2009. It is said, when we know who we are, we neither have to attack nor defend. Balance and blessings. I thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. The next speaker is Josefino Martinez Hernandez from Habitat Pro. You have the floor, sir.
A nombre del comité de...
On behalf of the Treaty Solidarity Commission and Indigenous people, we would like to greet the Permanent Forum and thank it for the recommendations made to UN member states. And here at this eighth session, I will talk about the tricky urban domestic workers. Lack of food security has led to forced migration of indigenous women, and yet they have no possibility of facing up to the serious problems caused. Some of these are caused by domestic work, which is one of the few employment alternatives available to migrant indigenous women and men. There are about 1,800,000 of them in the country, and most of the 6 million indigenous women live in extreme poverty and marginalization. 50% of tricky women are forced to migrate to cities in search of new opportunities for survival. They tend to go to Mexico City, they leave their communities because of lack of employment, and they go to big cities and have to face unemployment, insecurity, marginalization, discrimination, humiliation, and exploitation there. In the 21st century, there is still violence and discrimination against women, especially against tricky women. They suffer lack of education, they have reduced inheritance rights, they suffer violence at the hands of their partners, and a large part of this violence is never made known to the police. With the recommendations of the Permanent Forum from previous sessions, we set up the National Institute for Women and the Institute of Women of Oaxaca. The problem is that in these bodies there is no representation for indigenous women. In Article 123, Paragraph A of the Mexican Federal Constitution, there is express recognition of domestic workers. The Federal Work Act contains a series of measures that discriminate against those employees and infringes their fundamental rights. The labor law grants workers many rights and measures of protection in their work and vis-à-vis their employer. However, domestic workers have to face a lot more restrictions. We recommend that the forum instigates the government of Mexico to include more effective measures of protection for domestic workers, especially indigenous women. 2, the application of the Law of Rights of Indigenous People and Communities in the State of Oaxaca, Mexico, Chapter 6 on Indigenous Women. 3, the application of the federal law to prevent and eliminate discrimination against indigenous women and peoples. 4, consider the representation of indigenous women and particularly of domestic workers in the Institute of Women at national and state level. 5, the effective application of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the paragraphs that refer to indigenous women. 6, that UNIFEM programs carry out research on the working conditions of indigenous domestic workers with a collaboration agreement with indigenous organizations, and with the results of this research, launch an initiative or a bill in favor of women in this sector. Thank you.
Thank you. Nuestra colega,
And now our colleague from Africa, Margaret, has requested the floor.
Distinguished colleagues of the United Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, distinguished representatives of member states, UN agencies, indigenous organizations, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, I would like to extend my congratulations to Vicky for her re-elections as the chairperson of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Indigenous women have always been part of their people's struggle, whether nationally or at international fora. Today, in this permanent forum, I am pleased to see that indigenous women participate in great numbers and have a strong voice. Indigenous women are a priority for the permanent forum. In 2004, the special theme of the permanent forum session was devoted to indigenous women. Since then, a lot of particular recommendations have been adopted. The Permanent Forum is now evaluating the status of implementation of the recommendations. The United Nations Permanent Forum has a key role in advancement of indigenous women. by positioning the demands of indigenous women as a priority, providing a space to share experiences and strategies, providing the possibility to create networks between indigenous organizations, UN states, and UN entities. The struggle of indigenous peoples for the recognition and exercise of their rights have been long, and the improvements have been a lot. However, indigenous women and their people continue, in their majority, living the systematic violation of their rights. In this regard, I support the recommendations presented by International Indigenous Women's Forum, as it was given this afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Margaret. Now our colleague, Tonia Gunela from North America. You have the floor, Tonia.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairperson. My statement comes after my distinguished colleague, Margaret, has spoken on this particular issue. Since we share this focal point, I wanted to add that mass migration of indigenous peoples to urban areas has been a major threat to indigenous peoples, especially indigenous women. And this is all over the world. Removal and displacement, not migration, is the correct terminology for this agenda item, Madam Chair. In the United States in particular, the experience has been congressional laws beginning in the 1800s called the Vanishing Policies. Stemming from these in the 1930s came the Indian Reorganization Act, the Relocation Policy, and the Termination Act of the 1950s, and I think, Madam Chair, the names of these federal congressional laws speak for themselves. Removal and displacement has created loss of land and territories, military occupation, violence against our peoples, particularly indigenous women, domestic violence, street violence, racial discrimination, sex and human trafficking, HIV/AIDS infection, gender inequality, human rights violations, poor quality of life, and overall living conditions, to name just a few. This is the situation of urban indigenous peoples found in the United States today, as well as for indigenous women in urban centers throughout the world. As reported in the soon-to-be-released report on Urban Indigenous Peoples and Migration, a review of policies, programs, and practices by the UN Habitat, which confirms this reality. It is the economic, political, and sexual exploitation of indigenous women that cannot be ignored at a time when there is an increase in violence and trafficking of women and girls throughout the world. Madam Chair, my colleagues and I, who are assigned this focal point, would like to support not only the Indigenous Women Caucus statements that were made earlier, we'd like to support the Quebec Native Women statement that was also made. We would also like to support the Native Women's Association of Canada statement, and we'd like to make two short recommendations. One, succinctly put, that we recognize the right and fundamental freedom for Indigenous women to live free from violence, number one. Number two, that initiatives addressing female trafficking and forced prostitution have developed in Asia, Africa, and Europe, and most recently, the Council of Europe's Convention on Action Against Trafficking in Human Beings entered into full force on February 1, 2008, with many states still in the process of ratification. Madam Chair, we strongly support its continued ratification. I am finished. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tonia. The next speaker is Azuri Peacock from Oxfam Youth Delegation. Is Azuri here? Please raise your hand. Okay.
Let's explain to them that we are now going back to list A as was promised.
Okay.
We will be interspersing that.
Okay. Next speaker, Leonardo Cripa from Indian Law Resource Center, Organización Nacional Indígena de Colombia. Is Mr. Leonardo Cripa here? No. Next speaker, Armand Mackenzie, UNU Nations. Is Mr. Mackenzie here? Okay, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and Chairperson. I don't see Madam Dias, but I wanted to acknowledge again the presence of Dr. Erika Erin Dias for her immense contribution on the work on behalf of Indigenous peoples for the advancement of the rights of Indigenous peoples. And she is one I remembered a couple of years ago, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. She worked very strongly for the creation of this, the establishment of this permanent forum of Indigenous peoples, so that we, as Indigenous peoples, are equal partners in this forum. Besides of reminding Canada of its international human rights obligations toward our peoples, and besides urging Canada to act honorably by endorsing the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, I am here today, Madam Chairperson, to speak to you as a director of Mining Watch Canada, as a Canadian, and as a member of the Innu Nation. Using all three of these voices, I would like to speak to you about the urgent need for the Canadian government to address the environmental and social conflicts that Canadian mining companies are creating and contributing to around the world. The sharpest impact of these conflicts are often felt by Indigenous populations from the southern tip of South America to the far north of Canada, throughout the Africa, the islands of the Pacific, and in Asia. Most often considered a middle power, when it comes to mining, Canada is a giant, a mining superpower. With 75% of the world's mineral exploration mining companies registered in Canada, the Toronto and Vancouver stock exchanges raise more funds for the mining industry than the markets of any other country. Around the world, Canadian mining companies are contaminating land, air, water, wildlife, and peoples. They are dividing communities, dislocating land-based peoples, and impacting on traditional cultures. In Guatemala, for instance, Indigenous Mayan communities have organized to protest against mining developments by Canadian companies, and so-called community consultations have shown strong opposition to more open pit mining in their territory. And in Papua New Guinea, a Canadian mining company is causing massive environmental impacts as toxic mine waste are being dumped directly into a river valley. Community settlement patterns have been drastically altered, and forced relocation of Indigenous communities has been occurring as recently as 2 weeks ago. The realities of Canadian mining operations overseas are well known to the Canadian government. In 2006, a parliamentary committee tabled a groundbreaking report on the extractive sectors. Taking the Philippines as its starting point, the report recommended the Canadian government enact legislation and policies to prevent continued abuses and contravention of international codes and standards. In response to the committee report, the government initiated further investigation through a roundtable process that took place in 2006 and 2007. I participated in those roundtables. An advisory group to the roundtable that included the industry and civil society representatives reached an important consensus on recommendations to the government. The group called on the Canadian government to enact mandatory standards and implement in other mechanisms to make Canadian companies more accountable. It took the government almost 2 years to respond to the consensus recommendations. When it released its response in March of this year, the current minority government failed to live up to the expectations and implement the recommendations for mandatory standards, for an ombudsman to investigate complaints, and for government support of a company to be contingent on the company meeting international standards. Instead, its response promoted voluntary corporate social responsibility approaches to addressing the problems. In April, I'm very happy to share this information here with the Permanent Forum because I want this to be constructive dialogue. In April of this year, a member of the opposition introduced a bill titled Bill C-300, the Corporate Accountability of Mining Oil and Gas Corporations in Developing Countries Act. This legislation would have a much greater chance of actually holding Canadian mining companies accountable for their actions outside the country. I invite you to join Mining Watch Canada, my people, and the Innu Council of Nitassinan in this positive development we worked on over the last year by urging the Canadian Parliament to pass this important legislation. Thank you, Madam Chairperson.
Thank you. Next speaker will be Beaver Ladson from Arafat Embassy Clan. Is Beaver Ladson here? Please raise your hand.
Let's give them time because they are sitting in such a way that Beaver is
not here. Okay. I will call Ricky Tran. Ricky Tran from Cameroon Federation. Is Ricky Tran here? Please raise your hand. Here. Okay, thank you. You have the floor, Madam.
Madam Chair, Vietnam has claimed that it has achieved the MDGs, and yet our people continue to live in poverty. Many are losing what is left of their ancestral homes because of the current economic recession, which has meant that they are unable to sell their crops. Very few Quechua people know about the existence of the MDGs in Vietnam. Thus, we are very concerned that the MDGs will not be met if Vietnam continues to deny the existence of the Khmer Krom people as the indigenous people of Mekong Delta. We are encouraged that Vietnam has supported the adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. We believe it is time that we move forward and start the process of recognizing the indigenous people of the Mekong Delta. We would like to suggest the following recommendations. Ask that Vietnam develop a national plan of action for the second international decade in collaboration with the indigenous Khmer Krom people and the Khmer Kamtia Krom Federation. We propose an initial meeting during this eighth session, making it truly historic and also an honest and genuine shift for the social justice in Vietnam that could serve as a model for the Asian region. For that, Vietnam incorporate a legal framework for the recognition of Khmer Krom as the indigenous people into the national plan of action. Ensure that national plan of action addresses the current conflicts that exist between Vietnam and Khmer Krom through traditional and modern conflict resolution mechanisms. Request the help of the Permanent Forum to set up a parallel session in which Vietnam and KKF can have a dialogue to speak about Khmer Krom issues and how we can work together to resolve them. Seek the help of UN specialized agencies that are currently working in Vietnam, such as CEDAW and UNESCO, help monitor the current programs created by the government to ensure that it is culturally appropriate for the Khmer Krom people. For example, instead of creating more schools, we propose that UNESCO uses the existing educational institution that exists in the Khmer Krom temples and offer bilingual classes so that Khmer Krom children can keep the identity.
We have time for it.
us at Vietnam work in collaboration with our indigenous organization and UN specialized agencies such as UNESCO and CEDAW to create a series of workshops to educate about their basic rights and fundamental freedom, including women's rights. For 6 years, we have asked Vietnam to work with us and consult our Khmer Krom people back home. Let us stay true to the goal of the second international decade of the world's indigenous peoples and work together in a genuine partnership so that the Khmer Krom people can fully enjoy their basic rights and without fear and discrimination. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. The next speaker is Dina Bruyere from National Aboriginal Diabetes Association, Canada.
The chairman must start.
She's from Vietnam. Okay. But she's not from, she's not been able to. Please.
Madam Chairman. I would like to thank you for convening this important session, and my delegation highly appreciates the effort of the Secretariat and the vast majority of participants of this permanent forum aimed at protecting and promoting the rights of Indigenous people. We support the spirit of constructive dialogue and sincere cooperation with which most of the forum participants have been engaged in their deliberation. It is in the spirit that we commit as always to working closely with other participants to contribute to the success of this forum. My delegation is, however, deeply concerned about the registration procedure of the forum's participation. We believe that constructive dialogue and sincere cooperation can only be established if the forum is attended and addressed by right participants who are well informed and therefore truly capable of representing Indigenous people and discussing genuine concerns of Indigenous people. With this in mind, we are obliged to express our objection to the participation and statement just made by Khmer Krom Federation. This so-called federation cannot represent Vietnamese Indigenous people as they have been based outside the country for many decades. Without any knowledge of realities on the ground, but driven by political motivation, they have carried out separatist activities against the Vietnamese government and people and provoking disunity among the Vietnamese people. Having provided the forum participants with groundless and distorted information, they only prove that they are keeping a blind eye at the fact that the Vietnamese nation has worked very hard to heal the wounds of the war. We emerge peaceful and united, and thus enjoying a much better life. All the 54 ethnic groups are true brothers and sisters of the Vietnamese family, with an equal footing in every field of operation. Participating in this forum with such political fabrications, the so-called Khmer Krom Federation are actually discrediting this respected forum, misrepresenting the indigenous people in Vietnam, distracting our session and wasting our time. Madam Chairman, while maintaining our reservations about the application of the concept of indigenous in all multi-ethnic situations.
Por favor, al fin de la...
Please, could you get to the end? Thank you.
Right to response.
At the end of the meeting, please.
Try to be brief. While maintaining our reservations,
you don't have the floor, madam. call the next speaker, Dina Bruyere from National Aboriginal Diabetes Association. Is Dina here? Dina? Next speaker, Wendell Bollinghead from Cordilleras Alliance. Wendell Bollinghead from Cordillera Alliance, not here. Please, you have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The serious threat posed by extractive industries has been a constant theme in the reports of indigenous peoples, both to the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues and to other UN bodies. We therefore welcome the recent holding of the UN Expert Workshop on Indigenous Peoples' Rights, Corporate Accountability and Extractive Industries. We support the report and its recommendations. We regret, however, but are not surprised by the fact that none of the companies or industry bodies invited choose to attend the expert workshop. It is in our experience typical of the actions of the mining industry that it avoids open and critical dialogues of the impacts of experiences by real people at actual mines and prefers to finance and control a selective agenda of propaganda for the mining industry. We also welcome the parallel holding of an Indigenous Peoples Conference on Indigenous Peoples and Extractive Industries hosted by Tuptuba Foundation and the final Manila Declaration arising from the conference. This conference included Indigenous peoples with a wide range of open, bitter experience of dealing with extractive industries. We urge the forum to take careful note of the findings of the Indigenous Conference and incorporate its recommendations into your recommendations and action plan. The Manila Declaration calls for a development of a global indigenous network to face the problems generated by extractive industries and by the support given by governments and military forces to mining operations. Madam Chair, there is little time, but we wish to highlight some issues. Corporations are currently responsible for or directly benefit from serious human rights and environmental violations. The seriousness and the frequency of such incidents require nothing less than strict regulation and punishment of criminal acts. The Manila Declaration calls for a moratorium on new mining operations unless and until adequate safeguards and structures against a continuation of abuse are in place. We welcome the call for moratorium. What is needed long-term is a smaller mining industry based on the rights of indigenous peoples and respect for the earth. We fully endorse the call for an end to state subsidies and international finance institutions, financing of projects that violate indigenous peoples' rights. In the light of global warming, it is also totally unacceptable that institutions like the World Bank posture on their concern over global warming while at the same time continuing to invest in coal, oil, and gas projects that are the cause of the problem. Unless the World Bank and other financial institutions and corporations fully acknowledge and abide by the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, extractive industries will always be a source of conflict for indigenous peoples. Finally, we particularly welcome the recommendation to establish a mechanism or special rapporteur within the UN system to focus on the complex issues of rights violations, environmental damage, and issues relating to global warming generated by extractive industries. We believe part of the mandate of such an office should be to work with states to recommend legal reforms to bring greater accountability to corporations and improved access to justice and redress for their victims. We call on the Permanent Forum to call for the establishment of such an office and to call for necessary resources to allocate it for this body to function the soonest possible. We also hope that Special Rapporteurs and the UN Secretary General Representative, John Rogge, will be increasingly active in upholding our rights. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next speaker, Wilton Littlechild from Association International Organization of Indigenous Resource Development. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And this is a global statement from indigenous organizations from each of the regions. And I'll be very brief as we will submit the text in writing. The management of diabetes in the indigenous communities requires a coherent, integrated approach that promotes effective diabetes care and management to ensure optimal quality of life and to prevent or delay costly and devastating complications. As a chronic condition, diabetes is costly to the healthcare system. Diabetes care must be geared toward effective disease management before complications develop and cause healthcare costs to skyrocket. Therefore, in accordance with Articles 3, 21, 23, and 24 of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, we respectfully submit the following recommendations. One, we recommend that the International Diabetes Federation reinstate the Indigenous Task Force as it has great potential to address the emerging epidemic of diabetes that is now affecting our children. Two, we recommend that the UN Permanent Forum 8th session include in its report a recommendation that governments take measures to improve the social determinants of health for Indigenous peoples, including increasing access to healthy food and recreational programs. Three, we recommend governments provide funding for Indigenous peoples to develop culturally relevant diabetes-related programs and services to stop this epidemic. For Canada, this should include obtaining the meaningful input and full participation of Indigenous peoples in renewing the Aboriginal Diabetes Initiative. Lastly, we recommend that governments take measures to make diabetes medication and treatment options available to all Indigenous peoples, regardless of their status, residence, and socioeconomic position. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Next speaker, Russell Diabo from Indigenous Network on Economic and Trade. Is Russell here? Please rise your hand.
No, not here.
Ken is not here. Ali Hai Shatu from Bororo Social and Cultural Development Association. Is Ali Hai Shatu here? Please raise your hand. Next speaker, Christiana Saiti Loa from El Molo Forum. It's Christiana, okay. Christiana, you have the floor.
Which one?
Christiana, you have the floor.
Yes, madam. I thank you. And I'm going to read a joint statement, rather, by Land is Life, representing Confederation of Indigenous Women of Bolivia and the National Warani, El Molo Forum, that is my organization, MAWID, MBIDO, and others. to the 8th session of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Christiana Saitilowa from Elmolo people of Northern Kenya, speaking today on behalf of the organizations above that make of the Coalition of Land is Life. Indigenous women suffer from discrimination, racism, violence, rape, torture, and murder. We often face double discrimination due to attitudes toward women in our own societies. Indigenous women are the glue that hold our communities together. Any action that has a negative impact on women, therefore, has a negative impact on our entire communities. Likewise, any improvements for women that this body, the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues, can achieve will improve our entire communities and peoples. Therefore, we urge the UN Permanent Forum to recommend to the UN to encourage all states that have not yet adopted the United Declaration for Indigenous Peoples, and especially my country, Kenya, to do so immediately, to provide assistance to states to implement the articles of the UNDRIP and to conduct regular evaluation and follow-up on effectiveness of this implementation. To set aside specific funding within UNDP, UNIFEM, and other UN agencies to support Indigenous women's programs. To require UN agency staff to leave their headquarters in the cities to reach out to isolated Indigenous women and women's groups on a quarterly basis to allow them to accurately report to the UN on the real needs of Indigenous women at the local level. To include Indigenous women on the staff of UN agencies around the world, as they are the experts on the needs of women, children, families, health, and a multiple of other issues facing all of our territories. To ensure that states are held responsible for the security of Indigenous women, especially for their protection against rape, assault, and sex trafficking. For example, Indigenous women in West Papua are raped by the Indonesian military. Indigenous women and girls in Northern Kenya are raped by government security forces during military operations and raped and killed by cattle raiders. Indigenous women and children in Northern India are raped and sodomized by the Indian military and police. And all these crimes are committed with impunity. To adopt climate change policies that absolutely and substantially reduce carbon emissions in order to protect women's access to clean water, clean air to breathe, and food security for their families. We must stop the pollution of our shared environment. For example, women and children in the Amazon are suffering from unprecedented diseases as a result of oil drilling in Waorani territory. To ensure special protection for women who are human rights defenders, Indigenous women who seek out on issues, for example, in Kenya, Ecuador, Bolivia, and East India, suffer consequences and pay a high price. Sometimes they are beaten, divorced, shunned, or killed. To offer women's leadership training and capacity building for women's organizations to encourage women to be more vocal rather than be suppressed. In areas of violent conflict, such as Northern Kenya, West Papua, and Northeast India, to require that women be offered a seat at the peace table and included by governments in official conflict mitigation strategies, locally, nationally, and internationally. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of the Permanent Forum for your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Before to start item 3C, we will give the floor to Russell Diabo from Indigenous Network on Economies and Trade. Sir, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the Permanent Forum. On behalf of Chief Harry St. Denis of the Wolf Lake First Nation, I want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak to the agenda item of economic and social development. This is the first intervention by the Wolf Lake First Nation in this forum since it began over 8 years ago. The Wolf Lake First Nation is one of 10 communities who form the Algonquin Nation. The traditional territory of the Algonquin Nation includes the entire Ottawa River watershed in what is now known as the provinces of Quebec and Ontario in Canada. The Wolf Lake First Nation welcomes the establishment of this permanent forum as a venue within which Indigenous issues can be addressed on an international level. As you've no doubt heard from other Indigenous delegations during the previous sessions of this forum, working within domestic fora is often frustrating and has serious limitations because of the imperatives of state governments to protect their own political sovereignty and territorial integrity and their tendency to maintain entrenched economic interests, which usually implies denying the rights and interests of Indigenous peoples. This is the case of the Wolf Lake First Nation. The barriers to social and economic development are caused by unilateral, one-sided policies of both the governments of Canada and the government of Quebec. One of the biggest barriers to the Wolf Lake people's social and economic development is Canada's land claims policy. Even though Section 35 of Canada's Constitution recognizes and affirms the Aboriginal treaty rights of Indigenous peoples, the Government of Canada has a comprehensive land claims policy which sets out the terms for negotiations with Indigenous peoples regarding Aboriginal title. However, the terms of the land claims policy are not only inconsistent with Articles 10, 26, 27, 28, and 32 of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but the land claims policy is also inconsistent with Canadian case law. For example, the land claims policy requires the extinguishment of Aboriginal title, despite the Supreme Court of Canada's ruling in the Delgama case in 1997, where the highest court in Canada held that Aboriginal title exists in Canada and sets out the legal principles and tests for establishing Aboriginal title. For those Indigenous peoples who are negotiating under Canada's comprehensive land claims policy, their lands and resources are still taken away while they are in negotiations, and negotiations often take decades before final agreements are reached. The Government of Quebec benefits from Canada's comprehensive land claims policy because the terms of the land claims policy allows the provincial governments to continue to give Indigenous peoples lands and resources to third parties even as negotiations take place. Recent Supreme Court of Canada cases such as Haida, Taku, and Mikisew require the Government of Canada and provincial governments, including Quebec, to consult with Indigenous peoples, and in some cases to accommodate Indigenous peoples when making decisions that affect the lands and resources in the traditional territories of Indigenous peoples. However, both the governments of Canada and Quebec have unilaterally developed interim consultation guidelines as a response to recent case law. Those federal and provincial guidelines are designed to provide for minimal consultations, and the federal and Quebec guidelines are drafted to try and avoid accommodation of Indigenous peoples' rights and interests in favor of non-Indigenous land and resource development. In conclusion, we are aware that several members of the Permanent Forum have conducted a mission to Paraguay and Bolivia to examine what has been described as debt slavery of the Indigenous peoples in those countries. And although we recognize the Permanent Forum is trying to reduce the number of recommendations, but we do recommend that the forum members undertake a study of the Government of Canada's land claims and consultation policies in relation to the articles of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the resultant barriers to the social and economic development of Indigenous peoples in Canada. Thank you.
Thank you. Our colleague Hassan, please, you have the floor.
استمعت مازر فلون سيدتي الرئيسة أود أن أبدي
Madam Chairman, this very important discussion on the question of Indigenous women has shown that Indigenous women today are facing situations which have not been improved. This is borne out by the analysis provided by the Secretariat. With respect to the number of recommendations that have been implemented, especially since the last session and the sixth session of the Permanent Forum. Amongst the recommendations, and there are 67 of them, only 32 have actually been implemented. That is 48%. There are six others which have been partially implemented. We have no information for the others. We've witnessed some improvement in the participation of women in political life around the world in general and cultural life as well. However, this positive development has not been replicated amongst indigenous women, especially in the fields of education and health. Most indigenous people and women are deprived of education and participation in cultural life other than in the towns and cities. They're also deprived of participation in political life. So I think states are duty-bound under international human rights conventions to bridge this gap between indigenous women and women in general. This is a responsibility which also needs to be shouldered by organizations and other relevant bodies. As far as the International Year of Indigenous Women are concerned, I'd like to know if there's a unit responsible for indigenous migrant women. I have a question to Chile, Canada, and Colombia as regards the involvement of indigenous women at the national level in these areas. How many women can actually tap into their and express their cultural potential, and how many have the right to take part in political life? Furthermore, all the projects being carried out for indigenous women are minimal. With respect to capacity building, participation of women, we're talking about tiny projects. There are tourism developments and mining developments in these territories which are destroying the lives of indigenous women. So this situation points up the existence of the monopolies held by local authorities. And national authorities, this monopoly contributes to the marginalization of the indigenous communities. There's a monopoly over the riches, the assets of these territories as well. So in the context of this decade, for which the watchword is participation, governments must transfer authority to the plundered indigenous people so that they can genuinely take part in policy making, and the territories which have been seized from them should be returned to the indigenous peoples. Their rights should be enshrined in the constitution so that there's a real partnership with respect to these vital values. Thank you.
Thank you, Hassan. We will move now to item 3C, second decade. We will call the state of Brazil, Mr. Marcio Augusto Freitas de Meira, president of the Brazilian National Foundation for Indigenous Issues. Sir, you have the floor.
Merci, Madame la Présidente.
Thank you, Madam. Good afternoon, everybody. As we've already emphasized, the development of public policy geared to indigenous peoples is firmly rooted in and predicated upon constitutional principles, those which determine that Brazil is a democratic society, which asserts the democratic nature and plural nature of the Brazilian federal state. And it's in developing these processes of democratic systems that we have tried to avoid a system of tutelage so that the indigenous communities can genuinely contribute to public life. And that is how we've developed a whole array of public policies geared to those peoples. I'm speaking in particular in the context of public policy in Brazil of the right to education and to health care. Public indigenous schooling policies are systematically developed in a way that we have a mechanism for protecting and promoting the cultural diversity of indigenous peoples and fostering the use of their mother tongues, their own learning processes as well, the basis of which is a cultural system that upholds the values of the indigenous peoples and through intercultural dialogue. Education and the schools will have a new meaning for these peoples and will be crucial to developing their autonomy and cultural self-affirmation, developing universal knowledge and also making it possible to promote traditional knowledge and values. Ever since the start of the 1990s, the Ministry of Education and the Secretariats of State and municipal authorities are responsible for coordinating national indigenous educational policy in keeping with guidelines laid down in the federal constitution through a law and through the National Education Plan. The data of the 2006 school census show that enrollment of indigenous children in primary education has increased by 48.7% between 2002 and 2006. This growth rate in enrollment of some 10% a year is the highest rate in the population as a whole. 10.9% are in nursery education, 60.2% in basic education, primary education that is, 6.57% in the second level of basic education, some 4.7% in medium level education, and then the rest are for adults and older generations. 760 new schools have been created between 2002 and 2006. This number has gone from 1,706 schools to the current number, with 164,000 indigenous children enrolled in primary and secondary education. And we're trying to ensure that there is supply of teaching material specific to indigenous children, tailored to their needs. We think there are some 7,000 children in universities or students in universities, and we are developing affirmative action programs which are part of Brazil's agenda to foster participation of indigenous and minority communities. In 2006, the Secretariat of State and municipal authorities received some $9 million to build and renovate indigenous schools in order to meet the demand for places in schools in these communities. Over the last 10 years, some 9,000 indigenous teachers have been trained or in the process of being trained in almost all states of Brazil. Brazil also has 7 universities providing degree courses on intercultural education. We should also stress that this fits within the context of our program, including a conference to be held in Brazil in 2009. Regional indigenous education conferences to prepare for this Congress are underway. This will make it possible for indigenous representatives and public managers to discuss at length and in depth policies and programs to ensure that the right to basic and higher intercultural education in support of societal projects in each community may be implemented with legal instruments and management which is compatible with knowledge of cultural plurality and the need for development of indigenous communities. The right to health is another example of the thrust of Brazilian policy and the establishment of a national policy for health care for indigenous peoples. In 1999, a specific chapter was added to the Organic Law on Health, which set up a subsystem for comprehensive health care for the indigenous peoples as a specific component in the single health system based on a broader context of consolidating their own system, especially developing the principle of fairness and the strategy of primary health care as an entry into the system. Implementation of this subsystem was carried out on the basis of the organization of 34 special indigenous health districts, created not just on technical and operational and geographical criteria, but also in a way that respects the cultures, political relations, and demographic distribution, traditionally of indigenous peoples, which does not necessarily coincide with the borders of states or communal authorities. This territorial definition of districts, while seeking to incorporate in the public health system respect for diversity and the spatial distribution of indigenous peoples, thus respects the historic cultural diversity, which is different from the political division of federal units, tailored to the more general concept of regionalizing public health, the public health service network. Among the principles of healthcare for indigenous peoples, we should underscore the preparation of human resources for action in an intercultural context, recognition of and respect for traditional health systems, which are essential for the implementation of actions and projects for health and for focused therapeutic projects. Progress achieved thanks to the setting up of this subsystem, which has managed positive growing impacts on the health of Brazilian indigenous peoples is undeniable. Amongst that progress is the establishment of continuous services and professional teams in indigenous lands, the organization of a regular system of demographic information and damage, growing integration of indigenous people in primary healthcare teams, the setting up of participatory forms run by users and workers from indigenous communities, and the tailoring of the health system to the general system of universalization of healthcare. The 2009 federal budget earmarks $500 million for indigenous healthcare, which is three times higher than the national average, which has stressed that participation of indigenous leaders has enabled indigenous peoples to take part in planning, implementation, and assessment of public health policies, structuring their traditional health systems in a way that they are consistent with public health, the public health system. Over the last 8 years, child mortality has dropped. Interruption from the chair.
J'ai fini, madame. J'ai fini.
I'll come to an end. Despite the progress made in the last decade, thanks to specific policies and programs and investment in indigenous programs for indigenous peoples, this segment of the population still has the worst indicators. The Brazilian government launched the Social Agenda for Indigenous People in September 2007 in order to articulate and integrate Brazilian actions to guarantee rights, protection of land, and social promotion of Indigenous peoples. We hope that we will be able to work on the problems that affect Indigenous people the most, and we hope that we can respect their territorial integrity whilst introducing economic development and guaranteeing their revenues and improving their physical well-being and conserving natural resources and cultural aspects that make Indigenous people stand out. Thank you.
Thank you. Now I will call Nicaragua's government. Please, Mr. Stedman Nago, Minister of Affairs. You have the floor, sir.
Gracias, compañera.
Thank you, colleague and chairwoman. I think we should say that it is a pity that there are still countries where women are discriminated against and their rights and dignity stamped upon. Nicaragua really feels this is a pity. We have a law that was mentioned this morning that claims the rights of our women. According to this law, at all political, social, economic, and cultural levels, there is a 50-50 division of power and representation. And that's just to begin with. And that includes trade unions and cooperatives. We are talking about the different phases of the means of production. All of this has been legislated. We have a regional health care system which gives priority to women. That's regional, not national level. And that is a perfect fit for our Indigenous peoples, where there is a mix of Western knowledge and traditional knowledge, a system of bilingual, trilingual, intercultural education based on our own identity and reality. This morning, we said that we have legislation about our natural resources, according to which Indigenous peoples are the owners of the gold mines, of the hydrocarbons, of the forests, and of the fishing banks. And this is very clear in black and white. We would like to use this forum to say that those countries who have not yet taken up the gauntlet of the UN declaration do so, as we have done in Nicaragua. Everything that belongs to the earth, the water, the oceans, natural resources should belong to those who have been settled there for thousands of years, and which was theirs through a common law system and is now theirs through legislation. All I have to say now, because I see the chairwoman's red light, is that all the industrialized countries who have impoverished us, we have the natural resources, we have legislation, we have the will, we just need capital for us to be able to make a success of this. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we will call to Ecuador government, Mr. Kowi Ariruma, Vice Minister of Education. Sir, you have the floor.
Buenas tardes.
Good afternoon, colleagues on the podium and colleagues here in the audience. Given the historic reality of a country and the rights enshrined in Ecuador's Constitution from 1984 and 2008, the government of the citizens' revolution is working in the following fields. We promote interculturalization of public institutions, their regulations, and their policies so that Ecuador is truly a plurinational and international country as declared by law. We are carrying out pilot programs with bilingual education. We've been doing this since 1988. So we have now accumulated 20 years' experience, which is also linked to a healthcare program and the medicinal practices of the indigenous peoples in our public hospitals. So we are mixing Western knowledge with indigenous knowledge. We are implementing linguistic policies that contribute to the use and development of indigenous languages, encouraging the teaching of other languages such as English and Spanish. There are policies to recoup linguistic pride in indigenous languages. So we are decolonizing the memory of our population and strengthening our cultural, linguistic, and spiritual origins. We are working to recover the linguistic and historic memory of our ancestral people with a center for the language and culture of our country. Along the same lines, we are producing dictionaries of our ancestral languages and drawing up study plans of these languages and texts and ways to teach indigenous languages through the use of multimedia to facilitate language teaching. Plus, we are training school teachers in teaching a mother tongue in our bilingual intercultural system. A second step will be to guarantee the existence of educators specialized in indigenous languages so that they can teach in our cities as established by our new constitution. Finally, I would like to commit the participants and the assembly to draft a declaration which gives a higher profile and greater priority to the definition of standards, financial standards and support for indigenous languages so that we can prevent their deterioration. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I would like now to call on Mr. Jitpal Kirat from the NEFDIN in Nepal. Mr. Kirat, you have the floor.
Madam Chairperson, distinguished indigenous peoples' representatives, distinguished delegates, on behalf of the delegation of Nepal, I would like to extend my sincere congratulations to you, Madam Chairperson, and other distinguished members on your election to this session of the forum. I hope this meeting will help to strengthen the cooperation and collaboration among indigenous peoples and encourage governments and development partners and UN agencies to increase their support and commitment for the cause of indigenous peoples in the world. Madam Chair, we fully appreciate the work of the forum, especially on the implementation of 6 mandated areas, including the attainment of Millennium Development Goals towards securing the interests of indigenous peoples. The indigenous peoples deserve a dignified life and honorable treatment by the respective states wherever they live. international community, including the United Nations, should redouble its effort in protecting the rights of indigenous peoples by empowering them socially, culturally, and politically. Madam Chair, Nepal is a country of great diversity. There are more than 100 different caste and ethnic groups of people who speak more than 92 different languages. Among them, 59 ethnic groups have been recognized as indigenous nationalities by the state. They comprise more than 37% of the total population of 27 million. Like in many other countries, indigenous people of Nepal have endured discrimination and marginalization on the basis of ethnicity, language, culture, and class. Consequently, indigenous peoples have been politically marginalized and economically deprived. Recently, the government has taken some measures to improve the situation of indigenous peoples of Nepal. And Nepal has recently ratified the International Labour Organization Convention 169, which guarantees the rights of indigenous peoples over land and natural resources, and the rights of education in their mother tongue, and participation of indigenous peoples in the process that affect them. The government of Nepal has also prepared a comprehensive plan of action for the implementation of the convention. Nepal is also committed to implement the provision of United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. At the invitation of the government of Nepal, Professor James Anaya, the Special Rapporteur of United Nations on Indigenous Peoples, visited Nepal in November 2008 to assess the situation of indigenous peoples of Nepal. We are still expecting the report of Professor Anaya, Anaya's visit to Nepal. One of the main themes of interim plan, that is 2007 to 2010, is inclusive development, including targeted programs for indigenous peoples. One of its objectives is to promote economic and cultural development of indigenous people by increasing their access to administration and economic resources. The government has, in line with this...
Can I please ask you to conclude your statement?
The government has recently introduced social security scheme for the indigenous peoples who have been identified as endangered groups. There are 10 different groups identified as endangered. And national development for indigenous peoples, nationalities, that is NAFDIN, is now implementing some of the projects for the development of indigenous peoples in Nepal. Madam Chair, the interim constitution of Nepal defines Nepal as multi-ethnic, multilingual, multi-religious, multicultural country. The constitution recognized all languages spoken in Nepal as mother tongue are national languages, which can be used in the government offices at local level.
Can I please ask you to conclude your statement, please?
Yes, madam, I'm going to conclude in just a few seconds. And finally, I would like to reiterate Nepal's commitment to protect the human rights and fundamental freedom of the people, of all people, including indigenous peoples. And I call upon international community to extend its support and cooperation in these efforts. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jitpal Kirat from the NAFDIN. I would like now to call on a few governments who have asked for a right of reply, and I would first like to call on the government of Colombia. You have the floor, and you also have 3 minutes, please.
Buenas tardes, señor.
Good
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My delegation would like to make some comments on questions raised by two of the distinguished experts of this forum. With regards to violence, all Colombians, including indigenous, have suffered at the hands of illegal groups that carry out acts of terrorism and use money from drug trafficking and kidnapping, including well-known politicians. We have programs of economic and social cohesion and democracy. These programs have improved security, trust, and economic and social recovery in our country, and this has been acknowledged internationally. We have also been able to boost the presence of the state. We have reduced trafficking in illegal substances and weapons and have reduced the number of kidnappings. There is a law that has been passed by Congress which is reducing the number of so-called self-defense groups. We have more than 14,000 individual demobbing of members of the FARC, and there's also been a reduction in violence and crime. We have specific programs for displaced persons and to help them with $500 million a year, covering all displaced persons, including indigenous peoples. There are specific actions in line with the Constitutional Court's ruling on displaced persons. There are special measures and plans for indigenous peoples and were covered by the National Bureau of Consultation. We started these in 2006. There are specific programs for indigenous people in emergency situations. There are economic programs, educational programs, to name but a few. Of course, there are things still to be done. The terrorist groups that persist try and convert isolated areas into drugs and arms corridors and still harm Colombians. Unfortunately, some of these areas are home to indigenous people. The government of Colombia is doing everything possible to carry out its constitutional remit of protecting people. Bartolomé Clavero, I would like to tell you that Colombia supports the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Although this is not a binding agreement, we expressed this support in Geneva and repeated it here. Its application in Colombia is established in the Constitution, internationally ratified conventions which are binding are also incorporated into our constitution, and we take into account indigenous people. We have promoted an ILO convention according to which indigenous people must be consulted. In our 1991 constitution, we significantly increased indigenous ownership and have increased land tenure, and there are specific communities. 3.5% of the Colombian population is indigenous, and the percentage of land allocated to them is higher. It is wrong to say that land ownership is not recognized for indigenous peoples and that there is no prior consultation for legislation. This is not true. We have legal institutions, the Ombudsman, for example, and the Constitutional Court, that have also boosted the legal framework for the rights of indigenous communities. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the representative of the government, of observer government of Colombia, and I would suggest that there should be bilateral discussions also between some of the members of the forum who have raised the questions and the government, as well as some of the representatives of the indigenous people's organizations. I think it is our task to really thresh out these kinds of issues so that by the end of the 2 weeks, we will be able to come up with constructive solutions to some of these problems. I do appreciate the efforts being taken, but as you know, the situation of indigenous peoples is really in such dire situations that we really need all the efforts and energies to be more focused so that we will achieve more better changes for indigenous people's lives. Thank you very much. I'd like now to call on the government, the observer government of Spain, and then Vietnam afterwards.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me the floor. I will be very brief. The delegation of Spain would like to specify something that about what Autonomía Iraiki said this afternoon. The Spanish Constitution from 1978 establishes that Spain is a democracy governed by the rule of law and works in favor of freedom, justice, and political pluralism. The Spanish legal system guarantees full respect of human rights and basic freedoms. My delegation would like to say that this respect for human rights and basic freedoms is the linchpin of the Spanish government's fight against terrorism. And finally, Madam Chair, Spain would like to express its concern by the attempts to denature this meeting from being a place, a forum for indigenous people, to one of changing or introducing politics, and we would like to object to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, the observer government of Spain. Well, I think the issues that are being raised here are issues that have been, of course, experienced by some indigenous peoples, and this is being expressed by them. And sometimes there's some, of course, a lot of politics into it. But I think the spirit of the dialogue between indigenous peoples, governments, and UN agencies should really be that of a constructive character. And I urge everybody to work within that framework. We know that there are many problems. We know that there are many obstacles to respecting indigenous people's rights, but we also should appreciate the efforts that are being done on the side of states as well as on the side of the UN agencies. And I understand that this can never be enough because of the seriousness of the situations that indigenous peoples face. But I think that our task is to really come together and think of the best ways by which we can address this. And as much as possible, we should avoid very confrontational approaches, because that's not helping us in this dialogue that we would like to establish within the permanent forum. Thank you very much. I would like to call now on Vietnam. You have the floor, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson. First of all, I hope that the forum must be clearer in terms of rule of procedures next time. And second, my delegation would like to, once again, would like to request the forums to be careful in selecting participants. And once again, we would like to express our objection to the participation of the Khmer Krom Federation. We just want to ask you that how can a group which have base outside the country for many decades can represent Vietnamese indigenous people? And thirdly, my delegation would like to reiterate our policy of equality, solidarity, and mutual respect among all ethnicities and forbids all forms of ethnicity-based discrimination. This is guaranteed by the Constitution and laws, and is strictly implemented in practice through a series of socio-economic development programs. Apart from universal poverty reduction programs and projects benefiting the poor in general, two national target programs have been currently carried out with one aimed at providing housing and productive land and domestic water for poor ethnic minority households, and the other focusing on socioeconomic development for communes in special difficulties in mountainous, remote and border areas. Additionally, many preferential policies have been introduced, including subsidies and interest-free loans to help ethnic minority households start up their business. As a result, the poverty incidence among ethnic minorities has decreased rapidly by an annual average of 3 to 5% every year. Infrastructure in remote areas have been considerably improved, and common diseases in mountainous areas such as malaria, goiter, leprosy, and tuberculosis have been prevented and reverted. Ethnic minorities have also increased to a significant extent their representation in the National Assembly and in the central and local governments. The conversations and development of their language and cultural heritages have enjoyed great attention, resulting in the introduction of syllabus in 8 ethnic minority languages, including Khmer language, ethnic minority primary and secondary schools in 25 provinces, and the broadcasting on the Vietnamese television and radio and the Voice of Vietnam of 10 and 13 ethnic languages, respectively. Madam Chairperson, citing this as just some of the uncountable living examples, my delegation wishes to reaffirm our government's consistent policy to ensure the full enjoyment of human rights for all ethnic groups in the country, and we look forward to cooperating closely with the forum participants, relevant UN agencies, as well as other partners in this undertaking. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the statement and right of reply from the observer government of Vietnam. My friends, we are now at the end of our session, and we haven't moved yet into the speakers list on item 3C for the indigenous speakers are listed. So I would suggest that maybe we'll take some of these for the first 30 minutes tomorrow before we move on to the agenda item on human rights. But tomorrow we really have to be strict again with the limitations on speaking time. I'm sure and I anticipate that there are going to be many, many people who would like to speak under the agenda item on human rights. So I'm now telling all the participants, those who wish to speak, to please prepare your statements and prepare it for 3 minutes only, because the number of speakers will really be very big, and I can anticipate that already. So I'm urging you all, both whether you are a collective or an individual statement or government or UN agencies, I really would like you to limit your statements only to 3 minutes. So And tomorrow, tomorrow in the morning, the indigenous, members of the permanent forum will have a closed meeting in the morning. So we are going to start at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. No, and there are some announcements that our secretariat would like to do. So please stay in your seats for the announcement before I adjourn.
The announcement. I just have one announcement, please. You're all invited to the opening of the exhibit and a cultural event and also a reception at 6 o'clock and 15 minutes now today at the visitors' entrance area on the ground floor in the General Assembly building. Thank you very much.
Okay. I invite you to participate in the cultural event so you can also have fun outside of all of this hall. So we'll see you tomorrow. In the afternoon at 3 o'clock in the conference, in this same conference room. This meeting is adjourned.
Well, just to make an announcement, excuse me, just an announcement, there is an invitation by the Plurinational State of Bolivia to the UN for a side event tomorrow at 1:15 to 2:45 p.m. Towards a declaration of the Mother Earth rights. It's going to be held in Conference Room 7. Okay? Thank you.